Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Will, who's the most famous person in Chapel Hill, maybe today. Well, one thing we're going to get straight with the owner of the acclaimed Lantern Restaurant, and which was, when Gourmet Magazine was publishing, it was one of Gourmet's top 50 restaurants. The owner is a double James Beard Award nominee and now the author of a new book. And Andrea, one of the things that we're getting straight, I'm a German, so I say Andrea Reusling, but that's not right, is it?
Well, we pronounce it Reusing.
Reusing.
But, you know,
do
I think
people come in the restaurant and ask
yes,
the same? I mean, you're so cheerful about answering this question. You must get it.
German teachers definitely will say Reusing. Uh-huh. And, you know, people who are really into sustainability will say Reusing.
Reusing.
But it's
reusing.
Yeah. I answer to all.
Yeah, well, I understand.
Those are the
that.
Three variations.
Well, I was excited. I mean, we've been proud and excited about the acclaim that has come to your restaurant and to you as a chef. I mean, that's just, Chapel Hill people love for other Chapel Hill people to get national attention. But now, now you've got a nationally, you've got a new book that is recognized nationally, that's got attention. Forgive me if I don't get this right, but I think the Booksellers Magazine said it's one of the 10 top looked-for cookbooks in the country. You know, these things, it's all over the country. But you've written a book about Chapel Hill and the farmer's market and the farms around here, and it's a memoir of living in Chapel Hill. I mean, this is for us. You wrote this book for us.
Well, that's so nice that comes through, and I'm so glad about that. And I think that I wrote it wanting it to be kind of a snapshot of a community of people who care about food and of people who are really lucky to live in a place where there are 200 small farms within, just a few minutes, 20 minutes of downtown Chapel Hill, I would say. And that number is growing all the time. And I do remember a time, 10, 15 years ago where I felt like I knew almost everyone who was growing or making food here, and now I learn about new people every day that have been doing it for years, and so it's just exploding. And I think we all feel so proud to be here during this time.
Well, there are a whole lot of things I want to talk about. One of the things that impressed me is your intense advocacy for local food, and I think that the thing that highlighted that for me, and I want you to talk about it, is eggs.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm a cheapskate, and so I'm looking, now you've made me feel terribly guilty about all this.
Oh, good, I did my job.
But instead of looking to try to find eggs for 10 cents a piece on the specials at the grocery store, mm-hmm. there's another view about buying eggs from our local producers, and there's a benefit. You persuaded me to go ahead and pay 50 cents an egg.
Uh-huh.
And that I would get that the difference.
Well, glad I persuaded you.
Well, we'll talk about it. I mean, but that doesn't make that doesn't make good sense to reach out and pay more for what looks like the same product.
Right. Well, I think that there's so many ways that you can make the egg the center of a meal, and it can become a really fast meal to make and a really delicious one. And so, I guess the first thing I would say about the 10 cent versus 50 cent egg is flavor is so much richer and more complicated and more delicious in a 50 cent egg. And then there's the flavor, versus nutrition versus cost kind of issue. And I think if you're paying per unit, if you look at it per cent per unit of nutrition, the nutrition you're going to be getting, it's probably, you might have to eat, I'm just making this up, but you might have to eat 10 eggs of your 10 cent egg to get to the 50 cent. And who wants to eat 10 eggs, right?
Well, so, sometimes. You made me want to eat a lot of eggs.
Yeah. So, I mean, we eat a lot of eggs in my house, and we use a lot of eggs at the restaurant. And then there's just, when you go to a farm like Fickle Creek, which is not too far from the studio here, just maybe 10 miles from here, you see that the fact that that Ben and Noah are able to sell 1,000 eggs a week, or however many eggs they sell, roughly maybe around that, and what that has done to the fact that they've had they have this land that there are chickens roaming all over it, and they literally roost in the trees. Because they have these amazing dogs who guard them.
Who drive the hawks out, or deer and the coyotes. And
it's kept their land in farmland not developed. So, you know, I guess there's three reasons. I'm sure there's probably more for the 50-cent egg. And also, it's just such a small amount of money, really, relative to what we spend in a day on any number of other things.
Right. In your book, which is a special kind of book, and we'll talk about some of the ways it's special. But one of them is that it's an egg book, in that that for many of us, how am I going to say this? You think of meat and two vegetables or something like
right,
that. You
right.
think of an egg and a vegetable as being. I mean, you
right.
make eggs. You all must love eggs.
You know, it's so funny that you picked up on that. And I think there was a little moment of controversy between me and the publisher, because there's a picture in the book, a close-up of eggs in a carton that has kind of like a faded lavender color, you know, that purple egg crate color, but it's faded. And so it's really pretty. And, you know, we knew the book was coming out around Easter, Mother's Day. And so I was convinced that that was the cover of the book.
Oh,
just
so y'all
the
egg.
So you really honed in on the thing that, you know, and of course they dissuaded me because it was maybe not.
All right. Well, let's come back to eggs.
Sure.
Because
yeah.
I think this is.
I thought we were doing a whole show on eggs today.
All right. We'll do that. I think we could. I mean, we certainly could. Certainly could. But one of the features you just mentioned about the book coming out, and the book's coming out in the spring, your book. It's almost like it's not guided by page numbers. It's guided by the season, and your book opens with the spring. It mm-hmm. kind of opens like, well, yesterday, but so you can open the book and see what you're thinking about in late March, mid-April, early May, late May, mm-hmm. to see what's going on. And so when you go around and talk about it, do you open it up to the season that we're in?
Well, you know, I guess I will. And, you know, what's funny is the book was originally going to come out in the fall. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff I feel really strongly about in the fall, because I was kind of writing, thinking as I was writing that it was coming out in the fall. But I did, when I wrote the book, kind of, you know, had an idea of where I was going. But it is journal-like in the sense that I was kind of cooking. You know, what I'm doing in that day kind of does come through, and then there's references to farms that, you know, that have deeper kind of profiles.
Well, put the book aside for just a minute, mm-hmm. and let's talk about the spring.
Right now.
Or now moving towards later in the spring.
Yeah, well, I think food-wise we're at the beginning. Food-wise we're in the beginning of the spring, because I think in the spring there's this feeling, you know, at the end of February, beginning of March, people are really ready for spring food long before spring food is ready. And so there's this feeling like you're done with the winter, yet, you know, all we have is, you know, you go to the farmer's market and there's some overwintered rutabagas and some maybe some couple turnips, and then maybe starting to be some salad. And then there's a lot of onions, you know, there's a lot of chives and green garlic and spring onions. And so there's a number of wonderful things that, you know, you can do with that to kind of get your early spring greens. But now we're really at the time where things start happening. And so Catbriar Farm just brought us our first 40 pounds of asparagus.
I was just going to
today.
No, you're kidding. Because now this, if there's anything you love more than eggs in the spring, or it's asparagus in the spring.
Well, I think asparagus to me is a good thing to put in a cookbook when you're trying to advocate for just focusing more on eating local, because asparagus is so ubiquitous year round now. And I think that sometimes it's possible for people to eat asparagus every week, but never really have good asparagus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could eat asparagus three times a week, really, now, because they're relatively inexpensive and they're coming from Chile. And, you know, you can miss the relatively short asparagus season that's local, because it's maybe only about 5 or 6 weeks. And that would be a shame, because eating them now is really the time to eat them. And when, you know, when an asparagus is just picked, it has so much juice inside of it that if you put it on the grill or you put it in a pan, they actually bounce up and down. You know, they jump up and down. And it's like you're eating something that's alive. And it's the, you know, the perfect time to eat them right now.
We're visiting with Andrea Reusing.
Saying that right?
Almost. Andrea Reusing. Very close. Very
Andrea's
close.
We're learning that. And you better learn that name because she's the most, these days, among the most famous of our Chapel Hill neighbors. She's got a brand new book, and we're talking about it and about cooking. The book is Cooking in the Moment, and we're talking about cooking in this moment. She and I'll be right back.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square. It's locally owned, high-end shops and restaurants, and free parking on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. See you there.
Now, once again, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Andrea Reusing, and she is the author of Cooking in the Moment. You know her better because of the great attention that she's brought to Chapel Hill at her restaurant, The Lantern. And because she's twice been nominated for the James Beard Wonderful Award, and some amazing. I mean, when you came down, why did you guys come south anyway? You know?
Well, my husband Mac was already here. He grew up in Durham. His parents both went to Duke, and his dad works at Duke. And I came here kind of for the summer in 1995 or 96. 96, I think. And stayed.
Because of him.
Yeah. Don't tell him that.
No, but I mean, instead of, I mean, but when we are looking for people to thank, we ought to grab him and thank him for bringing you here.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a great thing.
Yeah.
So you came for reasons other than.
Well, I was living in New York and was tired of living in the city, and I wanted to see kind of if what it would be like to not live in a big city. And so, you know, I when I came, it was a bit of an adjustment, I would say.
Well, all right. Can I help you along with this?
Yeah.
Because here's something that knocked me off my feet about your book. And it's, as I said, it's your book, Cooking in the Moment. It's a international. Marketing it everywhere, but I'm just arguing it's for me. It's for Chapel.
Nice.
It's for Chapel Hill. And one of the things that made me so happy, have somebody from the New York area come and someone who's appreciative of the great variety and diversity of markets and availability of all kinds of different foods and food choices. Well, we hear so much from people who move down here. Oh my gosh, I can't get this and I can't get that. I've got, you know, I'm stuck and I miss my food.
Right.
Well, you say that in a nice way, and then you say, but I'm surrounded by an extraordinary variety of food choices that I was never able to experience in New York, so that there's an advantage to living here,
right,
food-wise.
Right. No, I think that that's really true. And I think that in New York, you know, what people forget, well, there's a feeling when you live in New York that you have everything and you have the best of everything. And, you know, I think so as a New Yorker, I definitely had that feeling. And then I think moving here, you know, just a few examples. One would be Tom Robinson's seafood market. Mm-hmm. I had never seen those varieties of fish. And I don't know that I had ever really seen fish that was so fresh unless it was maybe at an expensive sushi restaurant where things had been flown from Japan that morning or something like that.
Yeah, have Tom Robinson and his assistant is taking, I mean,
Salvador,
we've lost Tom. Is
mm-hmm. Salvador Bonilla is running the market and is driving to the coast every week and still doing all the stops that Tom made all the way from Harker's Island down to Wilmington.
Yeah. So what a great treasure. All right, so you persuade. I understand that one. Now, what about the other links that we got special in Chapel Hill that you didn't have in New York?
Well, just being so close to fresh produce. And I think, you know, what's happened here in the last 10 years in terms of meat, in terms of pork and chicken and eggs being produced on small farms in an integrated way. So it's not huge, you know, pig farms, but farmers having 5, 10, 15, 20 hogs as part of a system of fertility and productivity in small farms has made it possible for you to go to the farmer's market and, you know, buy fresh pork every week. And I think 10 or 15 years ago, we didn't have that as much. But things have you know, really, really exploded in terms of people being able to do animals on small farms close to Chapel Hill, you know, close to Raleigh, close to Durham.
Well, before we took our break, we were talking about asparagus, and that this happened at the time we were talking. This happens to be a time where you must be very happy because you can get your asparagus fresh from a local farm, and that's only for four or five weeks a year.
Yeah, maybe sometimes as long as six. Occasionally in the fall, there's a freak asparagus harvest.
Oh, really?
Which I think the stars just align right, and I guess the weather is perfect, and there's enough moisture. And it's happened maybe three or four times, I think, since the restaurant's been open 9 years. So it's not
so that would be a celebration time at the Lantern to have fall asparagus.
Exactly, it is.
And the wrap, I mean, of course, it's great to have asparagus all year round, but your feeling is that there's something special about these fresh asparagus. And can you describe that again and what you do, what you do with it to exploit that availability?
Well, at home, we just grill them because they're so delicious grilled, and you really get that amazing kind of juicy quality that asparagus have when they're really, really fresh. And once we get sick of grilling them, you know, we might just maybe broil them in the oven with like a tiny bit of Parmesan
cheese. Nothing big and fancy. Just put them out there.
Not really. I mean, I think I love them maybe for guests. You know, we would have them with really good butter with some kinds of croutons on the top that were fried in a little bit of butter. You know, of course, they're really good with a poached egg. Am I allowed to talk about eggs? Have I already?
No. Already? This is what this is what got my attention is too great. How am I going to describe this? This is just what you've done for me. But these are two simple things, a poached egg and asparagus cooked without a lot of rigmarole, I guess. And so here's the arguably Chapel Hill's greatest chef or among a bunch of at the top of a legion of great chefs that we've got here. And she says, poach an egg, grill a few asparagus, and you got a meal that is, you know, that
is fit
for a king.
I think that's the way most chefs probably cook at home. I think we like simple food, and we kind of fall into that idea that people are going to a restaurant and they want stuff done to their food, which, you know, I think we do. You know, there's all different kinds of nights of the week, and you want certain nights you want restaurant food, and certain nights you want home cooking. At the restaurant, we do more complicated things with the asparagus. You know, we make some crispy country ham, and we have it with miso butter, and we also do kind of a butter sauce with a kind of soy reduction with chive blossoms on it. So we do definitely do different things. One fun thing to do with asparagus is to cut them very thin on the bias and salt them, so you're almost like doing a quick pickle. And you can serve it with broiled fish, and so you just get that full kind of asparagus flavor. We do crab cakes with asparagus. You know, it's endless, really. But for 6 weeks, we just eat a lot of asparagus, and they're everywhere on the menu, and we eat them a lot at home, and then we kind of put them away, and we're done. And, you know, honestly, I'm pretty sick of them by the
What about the you share some of your secrets about the supply chain and about the farm. There's one farmer, I think, that you really who really brings you the best asparagus. But how do us ordinary people get them?
Well, you know, at the Durham Farmers Market, Catbriar Farm, they're great asparagus, and that's where we get a lot of ours from the restaurant. And then at the Carborough Market, Witted Bowers Farm, that's Rob Bowers and Sherry Witted, they have wonderful asparagus, and they have it right now. And I think today is the—I think it's the second Wednesday market.
Mm-hmm. Well, remember, we're talking for a lifetime. So
for a lifetime. But
at the Wednesday or Friday or
Saturday
market.
Well, the farmer's market for a lifetime. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's the place to get it.
I want you to—we're talking about your book, Cooking in the Moment, and the subtitle is A Year of Seasonal Recipes. And you've talked a little bit about how you do asparagus at home when you're cooking for your family, and then a little bit more intensive treatment at the restaurant. And so is your book a collection of recipes from the restaurant, or recipes that you like to use, or recipes and a way of food that you experience at home and with neighbors?
It's home cooking. It's definitely home cooking. There's a couple recipes that are from the restaurant, but when I decided to do a cookbook, I really wanted it to be the kind of book that people would keep in their kitchens. And people would say kind of from time to time, oh, I wish there was a lantern cookbook. And I think that those same people would maybe buy that cookbook and it would maybe sit on their coffee table or, you know, in another part of the house. But I don't – there's a lot of ingredients in a lot of the recipes at Lantern. And so the effort in this book is to make things pretty simple, things that you can make on a weeknight, things that have less than 10 ingredients.
Oh, I love this. So you say, okay, I'm a fancy award-winning chef. And my restaurant is well known throughout the world.
Oh, I don't know about
because
that.
We work hard at it, but it is complicated, and these things don't come easy. But let me tell you, when I go home, I like to do simple stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't like to recreate the restaurant. When I get my restaurant crowd together and we eat together, mm-hmm. we do simple stuff.
That's true.
And I'll share that with you. I mean, is that sort of what you're doing?
Definitely. And I think that I didn't really having kids definitely moved me to that point of view as well. I think before I had kids, I didn't really get that whole thing of like spend less time in the kitchen. That was not appealing to me. I loved being in the kitchen, and I wanted to be in the kitchen as much as possible. And you know, once we had kids, I think then you fully start to grasp the idea that, you know, someone's day cannot be devoted to making dinner, and that's a luxury that, you know, people don't really have.
We're visiting with Andrea Rusing. She's the author of Cooking in the Moment, a year of seasonal recipes, and it's just a wonderful book. We got lots more to talk about, and we'll be right back after this short break. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill, University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Andrea Rusing is my guest. You know her as the owner of the Lantern Restaurant, judged by people all over the country to be one of the best restaurants in the country. She's gotten Chapel Hill a lot of notice because of her fame as a chef, and now she's written a book, Cooking in the Moment. And Andrea, I'm bowled over by the book, as you know, because it's seasonal. I can pick it up at any time and turn to early spring, mid-spring, or late winter and have your ideas about what might be special things to do. But the part that honestly that blew me away were your essays about people and farmers and experiences. And I shouldn't ask if you got a favorite. That wouldn't be fair. But could you share sort of one of your experiences with a farmer or with a farm market that you share in your essays interspersed in this book?
Well, I think one thing that people kind of are talking about right now, and I would just maybe bring it up because we're in North Carolina sitting here on a beautiful spring morning, and there's pasture everywhere coming back to life and greening up. And I think, you know, something people care about a lot is milk and dairy, and we're in a dairy state. At least we were at one point, and now we're a net dairy importer. We bring milk into North Carolina, even though we really could, you know, produce all of our own milk. And we are losing dairy farms at a rapid rate in the state. And I think people have a lot of questions about grass-fed milk or raw milk or, you know, milk from pasture-raised animals, and kind of all these terms are evolving and their definitions evolve. But right, you know, close to town, there's a farm called Chapel Hill Creamery, and it's Portia and Flo, Portia McKnight and Flo Hawley, and they raise a small herd, about 30, I think, of Jersey cows who produce incredibly rich milk. And they, in order to do this, they decided to become cheesemakers, but their first step was to become farmers. So they not only are farmers, they cultivate the land, you know, they they have to irrigate a lot because the animals are out on pasture. But then they're farmers who care for these animals. And then at the end of the day or early in the morning, they're cheesemakers as well. And, you know, their story is I think, a special one because it's showing how they have about 70 acres, I think, and really close to Chapel Hill. And they're demonstrating how you can preserve this land so close to downtown, beautiful open space, and make a go in a business that most people are trying to get out of. And a lot of it has to do with the incredible, you know, value of what they're making because of the time and the mindful way that they're doing it.
Will you turn this, at this moment in your book, kind of gently turn this into a policy advocacy essay in which you remind us that, in your view at least, that the milk, our national milk policy is crazy in the sense that it encourages us wearing out cows, squeezing them, milking them three times a day, and genetically looking for cows who can just produce a lot of milk and then
right. I mean,
wear
I guess
them out.
It's kind of the definition of unsustainable, just, mm-hmm. you know, what's happening just in terms of the dairy industry. You know, as production, you know, is increased kind of through constant work on genetics, you know, dairies, big commercial dairies slaughter cows at 2 years old just because they can get a cow that can produce that much more, you know, even though a cow doesn't really maximize its milk until it might be 5 or 6 years old. So it's the definition of unsustainable. And there's really no place for a farmer, for a dairy farmer to go in this model of ever, you know, declining prices. And so I think that, you know, while we all want to balance our checkbooks at home and all want to have food that's reasonably priced, it's not something that we can really look to the future to keep looking at declining food prices. And we need to kind of think about a way to support people who are doing, you know, milk production, but egg production, meat production, in a different way that takes our community into account.
Does the cheese that's made at this farm, does it taste better than what I might buy at a gourmet grocery store?
Well, of course, that flavor is subjective, but I think it's very delicious, and I think it's a great time to try some of their cheese right now if people have never tried it, because spring is a wonderful, rich milking time of year.
Well, you obviously love the farmers. I mean, in the book, if you want to read, you know, it's a love story. I mean, that's what it is, not a cookbook. It's a love story about your love for the people who produce food. You really, I mean, it clearly is sincere. It's not something that you made up. But I wonder, the cynic in me says, hey, she loves these farmers, but they love her back, and she's getting the best food. I mean, they're bringing her the best food. This has got to have a little selfish. There's a payoff here.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I guess there is a payoff. I think, you know, I feel lucky that I know so many farmers, and I think we have a real kind of open backdoor policy. We have a lot of people who come, and we've never met before, who come to the back door of the restaurant, as they do many restaurants at Chapel Hill, including Crook's Corner and Glass Half Full, and, you know, Elaine's across the street from us. There's
a collection of restaurants who share this culture about believing
for sure,
in local,
you know,
fresh.
Magnolia Grill, you know, Ben Barker and Karen Barker at Magnolia Grill in Durham, they've been serving local food for over 20 years, and so has Crook's Corner. And there's a huge amount of support and a large number of restaurants in our area. Pool's Diner in Raleigh, you know, wonderful Panchudo.
All right, you said all the right things.
Panchudo
about
in Hillsboro.
About your competition.
Neil's Deli in Carrboro, Toast in Durham. I mean, really,
but
I could just keep going.
I know. Well, you love, you know, you pretend to love your competition too, and I'm sure you
that's
do really.
That's not true.
I'm sure you really do love them, but. All in all, when we've been talking about asparagus, you want them to bring you the fresh asparagus first.
Oh, yeah, it's cutthroat.
Yeah.
We want the asparagus. The asparagus is a good example of something that there's just a very finite amount of, you know, but there aren't many things, honestly, that there are truly a finite amount of. I'd say asparagus, watercress, you know, a lot of them are kind of early spring.
Yeah, well, Bill Smith's not going to tell you where he gets his persimmons, maybe.
Bill actually brought me a persimmon tree recently. So he's
well, let me, another just poignant part of your book, and this is something that kids who live on farms, or any kids who visit farms, have to deal with, and I guess all of us do, and that's the fact that when you're raising animals, you're raising them, ultimately, you're raising them to kill them. And so one of the things that touched me was your description of, ultimately, you were getting a hen. Worn-out hen is not the right word, but a hen that
was
an older hen, no longer economically viable. It reached the end of the production for laying eggs, and now it's time to celebrate that hen's life by eating it. And so you describe how one of your farmer friends deals with that challenge. Do you remember that? You remember mm-hmm. how you do that?
Ben Bergman was very kind and generous to slaughter a chicken with me on his farm and show me how he does that. And I think the kind of point of that is it is like a very sad moment for me, and that was kind of emotional for me, I think, because I hadn't witnessed a chicken slaughter before, and he. His way of approaching it is, very peaceful, and the farm is very beautiful. And I think the point really is that hen on another farm would have been dispatched at, maybe 8 months. And instead it was 3-4 years old, and it had lived this very full chickeny life outdoors and had been able to be a chicken as opposed to, have all of its desires and interests as a chicken be confined in indoor operation, in a battery cage or even just in tight confinement in another system. So I think, as you say, it was sad, but also
How did you do it to make it work so that you felt like it was an appropriate transition point for this the slaughter.
Oh, just that it was done in a kind way and a peaceful way and not rushed and just really. I mean, you're killing an animal, so it's not a beautiful moment. But I think when we eat meat. And eat eggs, really, because when you're eating eggs, you're also participating in a system that does involve animals coming to the end of a useful life. And certainly there's not a retirement home for hens like the way we all imagine there might be. Once a hen stops laying, they just
You got over it. I mean, this was good. I loved this. I don't want to make fun of this at all. This was great. But then you got over it and you cooked this hen. And how do you cook an old worn out hen?
A worn out hen. Well, this hen we made chicken and dumplings with. And then there's a recipe for chicken and dumplings in the book. And, you cook an old hen or a rooster in a pretty different way than you cook a younger bird. And
just you teach us how to do both of those things kind of simply, but how do you cook an old bird simply?
I think you just make a very flavorful liquid. And really, the great thing is you're just starting with water and vegetables. And so I think an old hen or a rooster is a little bit like that stone soup idea where you're just putting water in a pan with this, with parts of this bird, and it becomes this incredibly intense, rich stock that has a flavor that's nothing like a young chicken. Well, it's a very deep flavor.
You got chicken soup for the soul right there. We're visiting with Andrea Rusing. She's the author of Cooking in the Moment. She and I'll be right back. Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square. It's locally owned, high-end shops and restaurants, and free parking on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. See you there.
Now, once again, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Andrea Rusing and I are talking about her book, And it's called Cooking in the Moment. It's her first cookbook, but she's been surrounded by honors both for her restaurant, The Lantern, and also because of the national recognition that's come to her from really from her colleagues as a great chef. Andrea, you know The Lantern is a small restaurant.
Yeah.
I mean, how do economically when you you just got a few tables?
Well,
how do you make money?
It's a challenge, and it's a challenge. I think in this economy, it's been a little bit of a challenge, just because I think prices continue to go up in terms of food, and our amazing people that have worked there for 8, 7, 8, 9 years, payroll continues to go up, and so sales have to continue to go up, and so we have to be busier and busier to kind of stay, in the same place. But I think nobody really opens a restaurant to make $1 million, and I think we're not really super motivated by money, and that's not really what people are doing there. I think we're there because we love
doing it.
It's
just your little hobby?
Well, I'm not saying it's a hobby. I mean, 35 people work there. It's definitely not beyond a hobby. But I think, we have a pretty family environment and vibe there, like many restaurants do in Chapel Hill. And I think, we're pretty happy to just go to work every day. And I think for the most part, people who work there, they're not necessarily people who would be in the food and beverage business, as it's called. industry, I think
it's a little something different. It's like the family farm is compared with the corporate.
A little bit. I mean, I think that for a lot of times people who end up working there are people who haven't worked in a lot of restaurants, and they're there because they, want to learn to cook, or they're, interested in food in some way. But I think most of the people that work there are kind of motivated by food rather than money, and motivated by hospitality. I guess the question that you asked was, how do we kind of do it to make money? And I think we really do it to stay in business. It's just kind of
How do you make it sustainable?
Of course, to make money to be in business, and so we do. But
this way. See, I'm thinking a whole different way from the way you think about things, and I'm thinking about it. How do I make money out of this? How do you monetize when you've become successful and recognized as successful? How do you translate that into something other than the joy that you get from being recognized by your peers as being something special? Can you go out and give speeches? Can you write a book? Can you make a little bit of money that way?
I need to get a consultant to find out how I can monetize this. I just like that.
You don't even think that way.
I feel like I don't know how to answer that question. I think the whole idea of trying to serve a lot of local food, I think, is to create, you were talking about supply chains earlier, and to create relationships and chains of relationships in which every person in that chain, every entity in that chain can benefit. And so it has to be a win-win, right? Like the person that's supplying, grain to Fickle Creek Farm needs to make money, and Fickle Creek Farm needs to make a profit, and we need to make a profit. And so every player in the chain needs to make a little bit of money in order to kind of keep that relationship going and to keep that supply chain going. And I think when you have a food system that's in a small town and the players each know each other, it's a little bit easier to do that as opposed to in a longer kind of, more industrial supply chain where the idea is to, extract maximum profit at every step and to pay as little as possible for food and then to charge as much as you can on the next end.
Yeah, no, but I mean, this sort of is a speech for young people coming out of school, is that if you, like you do, like I think you're doing, which is to focus your life and your work on things other than measuring it by profit, but out of the satisfaction that you get from working with all of these people and into a family, that that is a more sustainable model. If the economics don't work out to make you rich, you've made yourself rich through the experience that many of us, you know, would pay to have of a happy working relationship with suppliers, with customers, and all of this. I mean, is that what you, I mean? Do you see it that way? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I guess I do. I don't want to sound that I'm totally like a nonprofit or something like that, because I know when people might come into the restaurant and see an entree for $32. What is she talking about on the radio? But I think it is. It's just those choices that you kind of make of how much you can charge and how much you can pay. And, you know, I think we open our books to farmers that we work with a lot. Well, and so they can see exactly like, okay, this is how much we're going to charge. And so this is why we can pay this much. And I think, you know, a lot of farmers do the same thing with us. Like, well, this is how much we're paying for feed right now. And so, you know, that's why we need
this
to.
This is a whole new, I mean, we're out of time. This is terrible. And there's several things we haven't done, including finishing this conversation. The reason I asked that question was I wanted to give you a chance to say we got a web page now.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, a pretty easy webpage. It's yourname.com, I think. Isn't that right? And it's new, and there's a lot of exciting stuff up there.
It is. And also just on the lanternrestaurant.com website, you can link right to the information about the book and then a lot of different producers that are mentioned in the book.
So we'll have some information. The other thing that we need to do is that right now, as we're recording this, you're in the middle of a sort of local book tour. And so look on those web pages, and you can find out where you can go and visit with Andrea yourself and hear about and buy this great book, which is called Cooking in the Moment. Andrea Russi, thank you so much. It's been fun to visit with you.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. I'll be right back here soon.